Welcome to Historically Thinking, a podcast about history and how to think about history. For more on this episode, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can find links and readings related to today's podcast, comment on the conversation, and sign up for our newsletter. And consider becoming a member of the Historically Thinking Common Room, a community of Patreon supporters. Hello. From the 1760s into the 1830s, waves of revolution rolled up upon the shores of the Atlantic world, confusing or destroying entrenched political and social hierarchies and ushering in a new era of democratic rule. These, of course, were headlined by the American and French revolutions, but there were no less important ones that quickly followed, not only the Haitian Revolution, but ones in the Andes, in Italy, and eventually throughout the Spanish and Portuguese empires in the Americas. It was a period of unprecedented and perhaps unmatched political, economic, social, and artistic upheaval. This is the canvas for Nathan Pearl Rosenthal in his new book, The Age of Revolutions and the Generations Who Made It. It spans multiple continents, touches on both the familiar and the very unfamiliar, both people and places. Nathan Pearl Rosenthal is Associate Professor of History at the University of Southern California. His previous book was Citizen Sailors, Becoming American in the Age of Revolution. Nathan Pearl Rosenthal, welcome to Historically Thinking.
Thank you so much, Al. This is wonderful to be here.
Well, as I was saying to you before we began, this brings together many past podcasts. The show notes are going to be wild for this one. Listeners might remember Jonathan Singleton talking about the American Revolution and the Habsburg Monarchy, or Micah Alspaugh, Friends of Freedom. His book on the Sons of Liberty as a structural movement to appropriate by revolutionaries throughout the Atlantic world. We can go all the way back to David Bell talking about Men on Horseback in episode 176, which is a nice it's a companion piece. It goes well with this book since it covers a lot of the same geographical territory. Not many of the same people. We'll get to that. Before and as well, Jeremy Popkin on the French Revolution and Colin Jones and the Fall of Robespierre. All this stuff is sort of, if you've been listening to all those podcasts, little did you know, and I didn't either, that this was a sort of an internal series within this podcast. So I wanted to talk first about how you constructed the book. There are interesting characters in the book, and I'm wondering, there are interesting places in the book, as I said in the intro. And which came first, the characters and the places or the argument?
Yeah, I mean, this was the central problem for me in writing this book for a number of years. I was very sure that I wanted to work on this canvas, that I wanted to work on this scale. I think we have a huge number of, the historiography of the Age of Revolutions in each individual country is so rich. I mean, it's an extraordinary richness. The depth and texture and volume of, the historiography of the French Revolution, the American Revolution. But even, I'll just, as an anecdote, the first time I went to the nearest university library to where I teach in LA and looked at the section of the library in under F that covers South American revolutions. I practically had a heart attack right there and then. It was like shelves and shelves and shelves and shelves of things that I knew nothing about, at least with some of these other revolutions, I sort of had it. So there's a huge density. What I felt was really missing, and I had missed it in my training as an historian. I had felt it from, all through when I was teaching. What I felt was missing was someone or someone's trying to kind of pull the story together and try to tell the story in a coherent way again. And I say again because this was done, in fact, in the immediate post-war period, post-Second World War period. There are really four historians who really tried to synthesize the Age of Revolutions in some fashion. The two that are sort of most comprehensive and most frequently cited are Palmer's Age of the Democratic Revolution, two-volume study, 1959-1964, and Eric Hobsbawm's The Age of Revolution, 1962. But you can add to that the work on revolution by Hannah Arendt, which does a lot of that synthetic work, even though it's of a different kind of book. And then Louis Hartz's The Liberal Tradition in America, which often gets sort of left off these lists, actually is very comparative, has a lot to say about the comparisons between the American and French revolutions, for instance, and European revolutions and New World revolutions. But really, since then, there hadn't been another attempt to do that. And, you know, Palmer is a magnificent, I mean, it's a masterpiece, but it's 70 years old now. And with regret, I say this as an historian who's just written a book, historical works do not last forever. You know, the accumulation of information, of interpretation, just renders them less and less perfect approximations of what we might want to say about the past. So I thought it was really important to come back to. So this is all a long way of saying I really wanted to work on this scale. And that presented a huge problem, because I think to work on this scale, you either, you know, the problem is either you cover all the area that you want to cover, and it's as if individual people don't exist, or you get really down into the kind of nitty-gritty and the texture of the local, and you completely lose sight of the transnational, of the wider scale. So, you know, the solution that I arrived at, and it was really through a combination of trial and error and reading other scholars, reading novelists, actually, who do this all the time, always deal with these problems, although we never talk to them or generally, you know, was to really do. So I think of it as either jumping up and down, or actually I usually think of it as playing the accordion. It's like sometimes we're, you know, I'll stretch something out and you'll get a good, nice, you know, the accordion is all stretched out. We're going to see, you know, a life or a scene or one moment, you know, 24 hours in detail. And, you know, I'm going to take you through interpretations. I'm going to show you sources sometimes. And then after that, we have to close the accordion up and get through a bunch of stuff in sometimes a matter of sentences, so as to move through the narrative. And so that's how I arrived at following some individual lives. So I, you know, the book, I don't know if you want to talk about this later or now, but, you know, the book sort of takes six, depends how you count, but it's either somewhere between 5 and 8 sort of individual lives that are threaded through the book.
Who are they? Just to give us people a sense of the variety that you.
Yeah. Are. So the only ones that are sort of really widely known are the Adamses, father and son, John Adams and John Quincy Adams. Most of what I have is about John Adams, although I did a lot of research about John Quincy. It ended up mostly not in the book. But then it's a bunch of people who you might have vaguely heard of or encountered one way or another, but who are not major political figures, but who are really at the center of political action. So in Latin America, in Peru, I follow the life and sort of world of a nun by the name of Maria Rivadeneira, who is accused by the Viceroy of Peru of being responsible for basically everything that goes wrong and there's a lot that goes wrong in the Kingdom of Peru in the 1780s. And I think it's just amazing. I mean, the Viceroy is like, this woman is responsible, a cloistered nun. But she's amazing. I mean, I just sort of fell in love with her as I was reading.
She's like the long series of amazing cloistered nuns in the Peruvian history that yes. I wish more people knew about. From Rose of Lima to Maria de Rivadeneira.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, what's amazing is that Rivadeneira, I mean, so I don't want to dwell on this for too long right now because I'm supposed to be saying other names, but she's still infamous in Peru. I said her name to a Jesuit there because I was trying to get access to her papers, some of which are still in her convent. And they were like, this is not that nun, is it? And I was like, yeah, it is. It is that nun. And I actually went to the convent and tried to gain access. I had a letter from anyway. And the response was no, muy privado, like very, like
really?
This is not for public eyes. So they're anyway, I can talk later about the irony of what they're protecting there, because it's actually ruining her reputation that they're holding on to what they have.
I think I can guess now from the foot. Now I know, I realize it from the footnotes. Let's get to that twist.
Yeah,
we'll get to that.
So another one of these figures is Louis-Augustin Bosc, who is, he has universal name recognition, but nobody knows about him.
Because of the Bosc pair.
So he's the namesake of the Bosc pair.
And I didn't realize, I mean, thanks to Professor Wikipedia, I was quickly able to verify that he was a French consul in Wilmington, Delaware, near where I grew up, and which I have to say, not many people have been. Yes. And also is the first expert on the mycology of the southern United States, which there's glory for you. But he's but it's a very interesting life. He's hiding people during the terror in his farm. Yeah. And it's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. An amazing figure. And I actually got to him anyway. He's a totally amazing figure. Again, you know, sort of vaguely known in French Revolutionary history, but not, you know, not a central one, but closely connected to people who are really well known. He knew Robespierre. Mm-hmm. He knew Brissot, who's the sort of Robespierre's antagonist.
One degree of separation from everybody in both the United States and France, which is why he's such a great character for you.
Yes, yes, yes. And speaking of, you know, Southern soldiers that you know a lot about, when he's a consul, or actually never becomes a consul, but tries to become a consul, because he ends up arriving during the Quasi-War, but he's dining out with all the sort of local gentry and whatnot, you know, all these American Revolutionary War veterans. So anyway, it's people like that. Then one of the other figures is this woman, Marie Bunel, who's a woman of color, born into slavery in Saint-Domingue, who becomes a close friend of Toussaint Louverture and Suzanne Louverture, his wife, and then also of Henri Christophe, who becomes the first king of Haiti, northern part of Haiti, and his wife. These people who were figures in their time and who just have not really mm-hmm. survived, or not, you know, really been part of the story so much.
And she's a confidant and almost a spiritual advisor, could we say? I mean, she's sort of, an emotional advisor. Maybe
it's a little unclear. It's a little unclear. Yeah. There are rumors, it must be said, that she has a sexual relationship with Louverture and others. I think that's just the way that people have of cutting her down. It's actually
trying to understand the relationship in an imperfect and kind of crude way.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Yeah, yeah. But she's got quite an interesting role, a kind of cultural figure almost in revolutionary Haiti. So these individuals kind of allowed me to, at the best, I think, allowed me to kind of, you know, I hope lead the reader through these very varied stories and to give you a sense of the texture and the kind of everyday life and the, of what's going on the ground in all of these places, while at the same time bringing you back to the major figures, the big stories. So anyway, that's a very long answer to your central question about how you get from...
Yeah, and places? Did the places come? I mean, you made an interesting choice. When we get to France, you're looking not at Paris, but Bordeaux.
When you start,
you look at, I mean, this is partly events, but you look at Genoa, which is a, God knows, is a highly particular place, which certainly no one else in Italy likes. these are choices that are driven both by the events, but also I think by something else that you're wanting to do.
Yeah. I think there were really two things that play in the choice of places. So one is I tried to choose places that I thought, connected well, had stories that related to one another in some way or another, but which weren't, sort of all the same. Bordeaux was interesting to me partly because it's an Atlantic port. It's sort of the place that it appears in the book is when I'm trying to sort of turn the reader's attention from the Americas, which is the focus of the first part, into Europe. And so that seemed like it's the port of entry, in a sense, of a lot of the people from that part of the world to France.
So it's Nantes, Bordeaux, La Rochelle, go with Bordeaux kind of thing. I mean,
yeah, I mean,
it goes with your narrative. Yeah,
that's right. And in a sense, it could have been any of those. I just, I happened to have I had worked in Bordeaux and the archives there and had kind of an affinity for it. But yeah, Nantes or La Rochelle would have worked would have worked fine as well. And one could go, one could list all the Atlantic, but those were the ones that made the most sense. But then there's also an historiographic, a question about how my book relates to earlier books. And you've mentioned some of them, books that I really admire. I mean, David Bell's Men on Horseback, 24 Hours in Revolutionary Paris, Colin Jones's book, Micah Alpoz's Friends of Freedom. You know, these are all excellent recent books that really tell, you know, an important part of the story of this period. And so part of what I wanted to do was to not duplicate what they were doing, and to try to, and then, you know, you could go back to Palmer and elsewhere. So, you know, part of the reason I chose Genoa, for instance, which, as you say, is a kind of, it's an odd place with a very particular history. Part of the reason I chose it for this case study, which is basically in the second half of the 1790s, so it's part of the story of French Revolutionary expansion, is that most of the scholarship is on Italy is about Lombardy, what is now Lombardy. So the area around Milan and Turin. So I thought, you know, there's more to add. There's more to be said that's new, I think, in the Genoese case. And the things that the general arguments that I want to make, I think, hold as well for these other regions. So part of it was trying to choose places that I thought connected, that were representative, but not totally familiar. You know, similarly, when I, in the American Revolution chapter, you know, why did I end up in North Carolina at one point, looking at a group of women who are sort of the first women to organize in the Patriot movement at scale. I mean, there are individual sort of small groups in Massachusetts.
The first one we have evidence for at scale.
The first ones we have strong evidence for, and yeah. It really does seem. So part of that was I was interested in that, but I was also, you know, I had a number of pages already about Boston I had talked about. So I wanted to also look at this part of the South and to say, you know, what does it look like, you know, in the Southern
and it background. Works out beautifully, and it's Eden to North Carolina, which is now a charming backwater. But it's at the time, North Carolina is, as any Virginian would tell you then or now, is a backwater. But it's a great contrast.
I got no dog in that race.
Hey, me either. I'm just a foreigner here. But it's a great contrast to Boston. But it's an Atlantic port. It's still an Atlantic port, but it's about as different as an Atlantic port in the 13 colonies as you can possibly get from what you've done already. I admire that sort of alternate, the different, you're hitting different notes on the xylophone, you know, as you were moving along. Yeah,
very much so. Yeah. Yeah. No, that was a lot of what I was trying to do, was to make sure that, and whatever, I could give you a list as long as my arm of things that are left out. And undoubtedly some reviewers will help out with that process.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll tell you what you should have included that they like.
I'm sure they will.
They're very good at that. But think of it, it's more books to come, articles, essays, you know, from the abattoir floor. So the power of hierarchy in the 18th century is really where you begin. And this is something I've had a hard time convincing, like a lot of undergraduates and people, is that how the 18th century actually becomes more hierarchical than the 17th century, and how colonial America, and I think the evidence for this is overwhelming, is much more hierarchical in 1760s than it was in the 1740s.
Can I get this in writing?
Yeah, that's my argument. But
I think it's absolutely correct.
So you tell your story, and I'll chime in.
Look, I think truthfully, I think the proof is pretty incontrovertible, and it's right there in front of your eyes. The problem is there is a long, glorious, and extremely powerful tradition in early American history and Revolutionary era history of absolutely, positively, under no circumstances wanting to believe that. And what's interesting is it spans the whole historiography. You know, before we got on, before we started recording, we were chatting, you know, you mentioned Gordon Wood and Jack Green, and they agree on this point. I mean, astonishingly, it's the only thing they do agree about, is that America is this kind of much more democratic, you know, relatively egalitarian kind of world. My theory is they all just spent too much time reading Tocqueville, who has this fantasy version of what America is. But whatever it may be, you know, the evidence is right there in front of you, and you don't have to do statistical studies to find it. Just look at the people who are in command of patriot politics during the 1760s and 1770s, and the people who are running the national government into the 1790s. It's gentlemen all the way down, pretty much. There are a few exceptions.
I've been thinking about this a lot in was relation to Connecticut. Mm-hmm. You can still have someone like the Trumbulls, who when Jonathan Senior Trumbull goes to Harvard, I mean, Harvard graded people in their entry class based on their social status. You were first in your class when you entered based on who you, your family was. You were last in your class based on who your family was. Yep. And Trumbull, Jonathan Trumbull Senior is like 30 because mm-hmm. his dad is a, you know, jerk farmer from Northeast Connecticut, which is the worst place in New England. Everyone agrees at the time. But when his son, Jonathan Jr. goes, or when little John Trumbull, the future artist, goes, they're like two or three. Mm-hmm. So we've got a world of hierarchy, clearly, but there's still, this is Jack Green's point, there's still ways of, I would say, the struggling up, but quickly then, like trying to rip the ladder up from behind you, which is what all elites do at all times.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question that there is a degree of mobility that people are able to move. There's probably more mobility in 18th century North America than in, let's say, you know, the upper reaches of Paris society in this period. But the idea that people there are kind of egalitarian minded,
right.
You know, I think your anecdote about Harvard just kind of says it all, is pretty far from the truth. I would say people have a very clear idea of where they sit in social hierarchies.
Yeah.
They're very committed to where they sit in social hierarchies. And again, I just want to be clear. We're talking about colonial North America, which, you know, virtually every historian of the subject would argue is the most egalitarian place in the entire Atlantic world.
Right. So what they would do,
this is the best.
Supposedly. Well, and in some ways, you know, whenever I read 18th century England, I have to agree about 18th century England. I have to agree. There are ways in which it is. I mean, certainly, you know, many more people can vote, say, in the colony of New York than can in Lancashire. What I came to it when I was like, I was looking at Virginia and realized the nuance of the grades of gentility that could exist in a very small proportion of the Virginia population. Yeah. And say, well, this is just a Virginia thing. And then you start looking at other colleges and say, no, it's not. Yeah. You know, Connecticut has, as John Adams says in the letters to Jefferson, Connecticut, Rhode Island, they all have their sense of aristocracy as well. Mm-hmm. It's different, but it's still a sense of hierarchy.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, so, you know, let's also, so far we've really only been talking about the white population, right?
We have.
And,
right. Yeah.
You know, if you think about a place like South Carolina, I don't know what it even means to say that South Carolina is remotely anything like an egalitarian society. By comparison to all of Europe, it's, you know, 50% of the population or more is enslaved.
Or how about Barbados?
Well, Barbados, I mean, absolutely, right?
I mean, right?
Yeah. Any of the Caribbean islands at this point. Or
Brazil.
Right? Plantation islands. That's right. So all of those places, I think Thomas Piketty describes the Caribbean in this period as being the most unequal society that we have evidence for in human history. That's what the 18th century, one of the economic motors of the Atlantic world in the 18th century is that kind of society, the most unequal society that we have evidence for in human history, where 10% of the population owns everything and 90% of the population, you know, on an island like Saint-Domingue, not only has nothing themselves, but is considered property themselves.
It's property themselves.
So we
should talk about Latin America, I mean, the rest of the Western Hemisphere, because one of the things back when I was doing a minor field in Spanish colonial history, one of the things that was beat into me was the Habsburg-Bourbon tradition transition. Mm-hmm. And I was always much more of Habsburg, you know, curious. But there is it hasn't changed, I can see from your footnotes, this mm-hmm. idea that something happened in the 18th century when the Bourbon monarchs took over in Spain and sort of renovated imperial policy and the viceroyalties across the sea.
Yeah. I mean, the underlying social structures remain largely the same throughout the 18th century from, you know, quite early, right? The Latin American sort of social structure, Spanish American social structure in any case, right, is a relatively small population of supposedly pure Spaniards, some of whom are peninsulares, right? People who've come over from Spain in recent memory. or you know, probably the first generation, maybe the second, and then criollos, who are people of supposedly pure Spanish descent. I'm putting air quotes around all of that, who are a relatively small group. And then there's a somewhat larger group of people of mixed race, who are Indian, some mixture of Indian and Spanish descent. And then there is the vast majority of the population who are native peoples, who are themselves divided especially into two primary castes, which is there's a kind of a caste of nobles, an Indian nobility, and then Indian commoners. And those are really important divisions within the world of the native population. The nobles for much of the colonial period are exempt from all kinds of taxation, have personal privileges, they have hereditary power of various kinds. So it's an incredibly stratified society divided by both wealth and ethnic identity or racial identity, depending how you want to define it. And then also within those by heredity. And then, of course, there's also an enslaved population of enslaved people of African descent in certain places. So in Lima, in some parts of Colombia, a couple of other regions in Spain, New Spain, what now Mexico. And, you know, if there is a transition in the 18th century, which I think most would argue there is, it's primarily a kind of flattening of this hierarchy in which the European born and descended are more firmly placed in command and the native nobility is kind of pushed downward to be not so differentiated from the native, but it remains very hierarchical. Again, it's not like some opening up.
So in contrast in say the 16th century, the very few Spaniards ever coming over, they want to marry into the native nobility. Say in Mexico, you're marrying into Mexica, Tlaxcalans, and so on. And that's really important for them because they're minor nobility in Spain, but now they can marry a princess and people and those and their children are ranked high in the hierarchy.
Yep.
But now in the 18th century, that's switched around.
I think that's a pretty good rough summary. So, I mean, it's obviously very complicated. Each viceroyalty is different.
It's so complicated, and the ways, and we're not getting into the legal things, but the petitionary structures are, and the way that laws are determined and viceroyalties is transitions as well in important ways. But let's begin not with the American Revolution, but with the Tupac Amaru Revolt in Peru. Yeah. Which happens exactly at the same time as the American Revolution, almost it coincides precisely. What is it and why is it important?
So the Tupac Amaru revolution, depending how you want to define it, I don't hold much stock by the difference between those terms, is, again, the core of it is 1780, 1781. There's a sort of long lead up to it that gets you back into the mid 1770s or earlier, and then a tale that goes into the later mid 1780s. It kind of continues parts, sort of elements of the revolt kind of carry on afterwards. But the real, the sort of core part of it is about 6 months ish in 1780-81. And this is a revolt, one of a long series of revolts. You know, in the colonial Americas, colonial Spanish Americas. But this one, the question really is not why is there a revolt? Because there are lots of reasons to revolt, I would say, for native peoples especially. The question is why does this one kind of catch fire and become this enormous uprising? And so maybe I'll just briefly describe what that consists of, and then we can say a little bit about maybe what theories there are about why that happens, why it sort of gets big the way it does. So this is a revolt which is led by, sort of orchestrated by initially and led by a man who goes by the name Tupac Amaru. Claims to be a descendant of the Incas and sort of uses the name of one of the last Inca rulers. And he's a member of the sort of a member of the native nobility, kind of minor member of the native nobility. And the poor guy is basically entrapped in a series of dead-end litigations, disputes with a whole bunch of other people in the 1770s. He's kind of downwardly mobile, and he sort of knows it, you know, from where his father or his father's grandfather's generation was. And he's very unhappy about that, and he basically tries to get Spanish officials, the church, various kind of groups to support him. He's engaged all through the 1770s in a bunch of litigation. And he kind of gets the cold shoulder. And at some point in the late 1770s, we don't know exactly. It's a little, you know, it's all remains shrouded in a bit of mystery. He decides that, you know, he's had enough, basically. And so he, with his wife, Micaela Bastidas, who is a sort of brilliant figure, not from a particularly prominent family, but a very smart, very capable woman, plan a revolt. They seize a royal official and basically issue a declaration in the name of the king, basically saying that in a classical fashion, this is a classical sort of trope in revolts in the early modern period, you know, the king is being misled. We're, you know, gonna sweep away all of the bad counselors and all the people who are, you know, doing ill, and, you know, restore the true rule, the rightful rule.
It's what Jews say in the Pale of Sentiment about the Tsar, and Bostonians say about the king in London.
Exactly. Well, thank you. That's the traversing the revolutionary world.
They all say the same thing.
They do. You know? They do. They do. And people who live in monarchies still say that to this day. I mean, yep. You can still hear that in places that have kings. And what's remarkable is that they then sort of call on all of these local native groups and leaders to basically arm themselves and come and meet. Form an army, and people actually do it. And so very quickly they have an army of, again, the numbers are very unclear, but it's probably in the tens of, you know, it's certainly in the thousands, definitely in the, probably in the tens of thousands. These are big armies for colonial Latin America, which generally has relatively small armed forces in this period. These are not large numbers by European standards, but relative to the population, they're actually pretty big. And Tupac Amaru basically starts taking control of swaths of territory around Cusco, which is the regional capital, the ancient Inca capital, up in the Andes Mountains, and basically lays siege to Cusco. There's a very strong reaction from the Spanish government once they realize, the viceroyalty government, once they realize what's going on, once they realize this isn't just a little revolt like the other ones. They arm themselves, and with the support of the criollos, basically the kind of the native-born, the American-born Spanish elite, they manage to push Tupac Amaru and his armies back from Cusco and then sort of pursue them to the south. Ultimately, he and most of his allies are captured, tortured, executed. And then there's this very forceful repression by the Spanish government of the revolt in Peru, in Upper Peru, in Cusco, and elsewhere. And this becomes kind of the nightmare of the Spanish government for the rest of its existence in America. This becomes the model of what you cannot allow to happen. A big rising of native peoples, because they are the majority, the vast majority in most of Spanish America. There are lots of theories about why this grows so much. Fascinating. And I would refer people to Chuck Walker's the Tupac Amaru Revolt, or Sergio Surulnikov's book. There are a number of others that really give a good view of why this happens. But part of it certainly has to do with the kinds of networks that Tupac Amaru and his wife have and their ability to kind of mobilize people. And so in that way, you see a connection to the mobilization in North America, you know, where in Boston or New York, part of these mobilizations are, you know, ship's captains and merchants who have these big network, local networks where they can kind of call on their clients to, you know, come out in the street, right? There's also a pretty strong religious dimension to Bagamaru, presents himself as this kind of messianic figure. Albert Flores Galindo, who wrote a book, which is translated into English as In Search of an Inca, really emphasizes the idea that Tupac Amaru sees himself and presents himself as the kind of return of an Andean messiah, might be too strong, but a kind of a return of the Incas, a return of a kind of just rule that had been lost. And so that, I think, also really appeals to a lot of people.
Which is interesting because, of course, that's a long-held Spanish idea of the last emperor. Of the El Murcielago, the bat. You know, it's Columbus has this idea, Charles V has this idea, a lot of the conquistadores have this idea in the back of their head that they're ushering in something. And so I wonder immediately, I wonder how much the criollos retain some sort of, you know, fear, interest, you know, in that as well. Speaking of religion, let's talk about Hasidism, which you note as a sort of, we talked about Jews in the Pale Settlement, and that's where it is. So how does Hasidism fit into this sort of model of this age of revolutions?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, this was one of the sort of surprising realizations as I was working on this book. You know, I sort of vaguely knew that the development of Hasidism was contemporaneous with the age of revolution. It seemed quite distant. And then I started reading some of the texts, and not only were they responsive to some of the events of the Age of Revolution. So one of the places that I introduce the sort of Hasidim as characters is in a series of sort of pretty well-known, actually, Hasidic wonder tales about Napoleon, where Napoleon kind of appears as a figure in these Hasidic tales around the time that Napoleon is invading Eastern Europe. So this is in the, you know, around 1812, 1813. So we've now jumped 30 years later, just for the listeners who are trying to keep track of where we are, across the ocean and 30 years later. But what fascinated me about the Hasidim is that they seem to map the kind of transformation that I was trying to map. So the story that I tell about the Tupac Amaru Revolution, let me try to connect it that way. The story that I try to tell about the Tupac Amaru Revolution is that, like many other revolutions of the first revolutionary wave, or the first waves of revolution, 1770s, 80s, 90s, it collapses in part because the leaders and the followers are not able to effectively build durable movements across lines of class, of race, of caste. And so, you know, for the Tupac Amaru rebels, the problem is they actually try really hard to make common cause with these criollos against the peninsulares. That is to say, the native rebels try to make common cause with the native-born Spaniards against the Spanish administrators and officials and merchants and whatever coming from Spain. And they just can't do it. The divide is too deep, too strong. They can't kind of cross the bridge. And the story that I try to tell really in the whole book is of a transition between this early phase of series of revolutions to revolutions that actually manage to operate at scale over time. And what I found fascinating about Hasidism, obviously it's mostly a religious movement, not primarily a kind of political movement, although it does have political implications. But what I found fascinating about it was that the generational transformation within Hasidism was very, very similar. Before 1800, Hasidism is a small movement, pretty much, you know, sticking to a relatively small educated elite, sort of talking the talk of kind of universal access to the divine, which is kind of what Hasidism is all about, but really not able to kind of reach this mass audience. And just the same way as the more political revolutionary movements shift around 1800, Hasidism shifts around 1800. And by like 1815, suddenly you have these huge mass religious movements with, again, political implications and political effects. which seemed to come out of nowhere. And I thought it was a really useful, I thought looking at Hasidism was a really useful way of showing, look, the transition that's happening here is not just, you know, people who've had experience with revolutionary organizing who are getting better and better at mass political organizing. There's a real cultural and worldview shift that takes place around 1800. And this is where the claim about revolutions come in. I think there's a real generational shift here, which is visible not only in the sort of strictly speaking political sphere, but comes out as well in, you know, in the organization of religious, of large-scale religious movements, which are in their own way, right, revolutionary, which try to really transform the way people act in the world.
So before we get to that, I want to put a marker on there and return to that, because sure, that just inspired a lot of interesting thoughts. In the 1780s, the Netherlands, perhaps under the influence of the American Revolution, has what you've referred to as a top-down revolution. Aging commercial republic, a bit quiescent, a bit semi-senile, but in Genoa in the 1790s, a much more senile and quiescent and ossified commercial republic also has a top-down revolution. And yet they're different because something has happened in between them, which is the French Revolution. Rather than banging on about the French Revolution, perhaps the best way of tracing its influences is to look at the differences between the Dutch Revolution and the Genoese Revolution, and briskly then seeing the differences, we might be able to see the influence of the French Revolution.
Sure, sure. You know, so I think I mean, there are lots of differences between these two revolutions, yeah. And I feel like I never stop saying, you know, of course each of these cases is distinct, but I think you're absolutely right to pair them in that sense, that they are both, you know, revolutions in relatively small countries, which have a kind of oligarchical republican organization.
Very small hinterland, able to be invaded by their neighbors, unfortunately. That's
right.
For them.
That's right. That's right. And in some ways, both of these stories end the same way. In both of them, the revolutions are curbed or crushed in some fashion, more so in the Netherlands in the 1780s than in Genoa in the 1790s. The real difference that I perceived between, you know, that I think you're pointing to here, is that although in both cases the revolutions are really pushed forward by a relatively small, frankly somewhat insular political elite, the way that the Genoese revolutionaries in the late 1790s, so we're talking the 1797-89 basically, what's called the triennio in Italy, this three-year sort of republican interlude. The real difference in quality to me was that the revolutionaries in Genoa in those years seemed to really understand that they have to try to communicate with a mass audience on its own terms. So what I mean by that is the Dutch revolutionaries of the 1780s are trying to speak to a broader public. Famously, I mean, the most amazing illustration of this is in 1780 or 81 off the top of my head. I think it's 81. It's in the book in any case. Johann Dirk von der Capelle, who is this extremely very high-ranking nobleman, Dutch nobleman of a very old family, a sort of liberal nobleman. He's kind of constantly in opposition to the government, and he's kind of a bit of a gadfly. He writes this pamphlet called Aan het Volk van Nederland, so to the people of the Netherlands, and he has it distributed across the entire country in one night. You know, people wake up basically to have it on their doorstep all across the country. But if you read this pamphlet, and so this has been presented many times as a kind of amazing democratic, you know, call to arms. I mean, if you read the pamphlet, it's dense beyond belief. Lots of political theory. I mean, there are moments where he sort of goes out into a more, but you know, it's like a 70-page pamphlet. There's not a lot of evidence that the masses, so to speak, are actually reading this.
It's not Tom Paine. It's not like it's not good, you know, from the street propaganda.
Well, for sure. And it's not, you know, the newspaper press of the American Revolution either, right, which also has its limitations. So there's a lot of this kind of, you know, effort to talk at the populace in the 1780s, very early 1790s. You see that in the United States as well, the early United States. But I think it's remarkably unforgiving and unadapted to a kind of mass audience. And what's different, I think, you see in Genoa is there's at least, they don't really succeed for all sorts of reasons, but they're clearly thinking about how do we, and this is, I think, partly what they've tried to learn from the French revolutionaries of the earlier in the decade, how do we actually do things in public for the populace, with the populace, that will actually make them think differently about the political structures. And one of my favorite anecdotes is this newspaper article that I came upon where one of the Genoese revolutionaries proposes that every week, everyone should be obliged to make themselves a simple meal and sit out on their stoop and eat it. And I just love this idea of, and they actually specify, you know, it's just going to be basically, you know, a soup and a, you know, and a main dish.
A minestra.
A
Genoese go to minestrone in times of trouble.
So that's exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. It's a minestra. Yeah. And the idea is everybody will be able to eat this. Everybody, and you're going to be sitting there looking at your neighbors, right? And kind of having this Republican moment in the spaces of the city.
Sounds like the Lower East Side in the 1890s, myself to me.
In a way, I think that's what they're trying to accomplish, right? They're trying to accomplish a kind of opening of the public space, right? A kind of cracking open of, you know, so that nobles, the well-off, the wealthy merchants are going to have to go out of their, you know, their palazzi and sit out in the street with the artisans and kind of participate in this in this urban life. So that, I think that's a pretty, you know, the beginnings of a significant change.
And that's based on a seeing years of sort of public spectacle and performance, revolutionist performance and spectacle in Paris and throughout France.
That's right.
But no mass executions were suggested as like no people putting people on rafts out in the harbor or something like that and then sinking them. I mean, that doesn't happen.
No, not in Genoa. No, in Genoa, the problem they have is that the city of Genoa itself is sort of divided half and half between revolutionaries, or maybe a third, two-thirds between revolutionaries and anti-revolutionaries. But then the outlying villages are incredibly resistant. Wow. And so they're basically engaged in a kind of guerrilla warfare with their own hinterland.
Those are my ancestors. I don't know if I'm proud or happy to say that, but you know, up in the hills, resistant to anybody telling them anything about everything. So,
yeah. And place, we can right?
Place. We can get into Corsica too, which is part of this. But let's. We need to move forward. We're starting to run dangerously near out of time. Those are top-down revolutions. You also refer to, let me get this right, to monarchic revolutions. Now, is this before we get to that, let's talk about the Haitian Revolution.
Sure.
Is the Haitian Revolution, is it actually, does it require the French Revolution to begin? That's often the way that the story is told. And is the French Revolution necessary? As we're talking about the influence of the American Revolution, and, you know, I need to study this for myself, I've often wondered, there are a hell of a lot of New England ship captains from Massachusetts, mm-hmm. as you well know, mm-hmm. and blacks who are members of crew who can tell them what's happening in Pennsylvania and Massachusetts.
Oh, definitely.
And so how should we think of it and its influence? Because we'll see that it's immensely influential on the rest of Latin America.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me that the right answer is sort of yes and no.
Of course.
You know, it's no in the sense that there's no question that the enslaved people of Haiti would have become free one way or another, just as enslaved people everywhere else in the Atlantic world did eventually, some through, you know, some combination of revolt, self-emancipation, and, you know.
And certainly it's not as if there wasn't a history of revolts in Saint-Domingue or the rest of the Caribbean.
Certainly.
It's when revolts suddenly take on a universalistic aspiration that makes them maybe perhaps that's when it makes them a revolution. I don't know.
I mean, you know, I would just recommend to your listeners, if they don't know it already, Vince Brown's Tacky's Revolt, which I think does a wonderful job of showing how there are currents of revolt sort of coursing through the Caribbean, really based on African. His argument is it's basically African warfare translated to and carried on in the New World. And I think there's, that's a pretty convincing thesis, even if the evidence is sort of inevitably rather fragmentary. I think what the French Revolution does, and it does this in many places, it's not just in Haiti, it's true in the Netherlands in the 1790s, it's true in Italy, it's true in Spain, is it kind of cracks open damages the existing political order and makes room for much more well-organized and much more successful revolts, whether that's by preventing immediate military intervention from putting down revolts, whether it, means, that there are alliances that develop. So I suppose that's, the proximate cause of the beginning of the Haitian Revolution is certainly in part the influence of the French, but it's definitely the case that the long distance, the long range causes of the Haitian Revolution are their own. I mean, they didn't need France to know that French people to tell them that slavery was not a good thing. That was pretty clear.
And it was, so it was better to be free once again. The monarchical revolutions, briefly, monarchic revolutions, what are they?
Yeah. Well, I was interested in the idea that, we tend to, when we think about the revolutions of this period, it's as if when monarchies reappear somehow, which in many cases they do, somehow the revolution is over. And that struck me as a curious way to think about things. In other words, by that account, Haiti is revolutionary from 1791 to 1803, and then stops being revolutionary. Doesn't seem very convincing. France is revolutionary. I mean, I could go on and on, but it then means France is revolutionary from X date to X date. And I think
ruins everything. It's kind of,
even more confusing because does it stop the minute that he becomes first consul, or does it stop only when he becomes first consul for life, or is it when he becomes emperor? Or does the revolution continue through the Napoleonic period?
And then we get, quite frankly, Napoleon apologists, many of them who are English academics who have gone badly astray. And when you start to, when you're English and start to boost Napoleon, I think you've got serious problems going on. But who will argue that Napoleon's a revolutionary all his life. Now, I would like to find a way of splitting the difference somehow, but I'm not sure. Is that possible? I don't know. But go on.
Well, I think I think it's important to think about the ways in which some of these monarchical regimes continue revolutionary projects, and in many cases are carrying on politically along the same lines as, by politically, I mean in terms of their political organization, are in many ways adopting the modes and practices of revolutionary politics. So, one of the examples that I try to push forward is the Dutch monarchy after 1815, which, worth noting, the Dutch don't have a monarchy until 1815. That's the newest monarchy in Europe. And so it's this weird situation where this king, who, just to again hit the generational note, had been a child during the Patriot Revolt of the 1780s, and so had lived through that, and is now kind of a late middle-aged, crotchety old guy, King William I. So he's this new monarch, right? So how do you build the legitimacy of a monarchy that has no, you know, we're not talking about a monarchy that goes back to William the Conqueror. This is like, from one day to the next, he becomes king of the Netherlands. And it turns out a lot of what he does is borrow from the revolutionary's playbook of the previous 25 years. He may not like the idea that, you know, the anti-monarchical aspects of the revolutionary playbook, but as far as organizing large-scale political movements to back him, he's all in on that. And he's using many of the same techniques. He's using the press, he's using the government, he's using a sort of a powerful administration. So in many ways, I think this is, should be seen in an element of continuity rather than seen as some kind of sharp rupture. Now doing that, I'll say, the sort of the cost of that is that it means that we have to think about the ways in which we might be able to talk about revolutions which are not just liberatory in their direction. But this
is actually a very old story in history, right? I mean, Caesar is a revolutionary. He also mm-hmm. destroys whatever is democratic left in the Roman That's Republic. Right. And Augustus, in the next generation, and this is gets to an argument that you make throughout the book that we're about mm-hmm. to get to, there's a generational long, maybe two generations long revolution in Rome that we see that is really anti-democratic. We could go back to lots of Greek states and see the same thing. The Russian Revolution. Let's face it, it's an anti-democratic movement. Absolutely. Ultimately, the Nazi Revolution is a revolution, and it's anti-democratic, and it's determined to destroy. It's going to destroy most of what has gone before and replace everything that's beneath. Maybe some facades of eagles and imperial glory and crap like that. But these are all, so you can have an anti-democratic revolution. I don't think that shouldn't be arguable.
I think for the 18th century, for the late 18th and early 19th century, it has been the case that most people who talk about it think of it as, to quote R.R. Palmer, the title of R.R. Palmer's book, so we're not getting too deeply into the book here, but the age of the democratic revolution. For him, right. Palmer's argument is what's revolutionary about this period is the democratic dimension.
He's not wrong. And this is the problem with the word revolution, which, you know, even at the time is in the midst of flux. What the hell are we talking about? I mean, in a way, a monarchical revolution is Dr. Johnson's idea of revolution. It's starting, it's doing a 360. You know, yeah. I mean, you completely transform yourself, but come back to where you were at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know,
I think just to go back to the example of Haiti, which I think in some ways is, I mean, I don't just, it's not in my chapter where I talk about monarchical revolution, but it is that
it
because
could be.
Christophe, who becomes the king of Haiti in 1806, a fascinating and really misunderstood figure. There actually, a biography was just published of him and another biography is about to come out.
Yeah, I saw that come out.
So Paul Clymer's Black Crown, and then I think Marlena Dott at Yale is going to be publishing a biography as well. Super fascinating figure. So he's the king of Haiti for 15 years almost. And he's nothing if not a revolutionary. The man spent the previous 15 years in the crucible, in the heart of revolutionary Haiti. And he devotes himself in a way that's, you know, in one aspect, very, very inspiring. He devotes himself to protecting the freedom, collective freedom from slavery of his countrymen. At the same time, he's incredibly repressive, basically reinstitutes a plantation regime, and there is like no space for dissent or very little space for dissent within his regime. So, you know, it's highly militarized state. Is that not revolutionary? Again, I think if you're going to rule that out of the category of revolutions, I think you've got a real problem with your definition of revolution in the 18th century. And this is, back to the initial question that you asked me, this is why I felt it was so important to revisit Palmer today, to come back to this big scale, because I just don't think you can say, well, we have this synthesis that's, you know, the age of the democratic revolution, and also we're going to add Haiti. Mm-hmm. To me, Haiti is, and then Latin America is, you know, South America as well, when you think about you know, the kinds of the junta governments of the 18 teens and 20s, it completely upends the idea that this is fundamentally about democratic revolutions. This is about all different kinds of rapid, dramatic political change.
No, it's the revelatory part of the book for me is to make me realize how I could combine things into one basket rather than having to somewhat arbitrarily toss them out. I mean, I can still prefer, you know, democratic revolutions that create democratic republics. I much prefer to live in one than, you know,
let's hope it lasts.
Yeah, exactly. So, long may it last. That's our task. But let's finish up with South America. Yeah. Because we began the conversation with the Tupac Amaru revolution. Yeah. Some point, maybe when I was reading, Black History comics about the Haitian Revolution, or about Latin American revolutions, if you start with Francisco Miranda, and you go past the death of Bolivar, it's a long time. And if you go back to the beginning of the Tupac Amaru revolt, if you don't focus on just certain criollos like Miranda or Bolivar, it's even longer.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is an important argument you make. As I said, before we began, it's both historians and citizens. We have a sort of ADD. We have an attention deficit disorder. It's also, I think, the facts of specialization and periodization. We're going to disentangle Miranda from Bolivar sometimes, or it's just a little prelude. We certainly disentangle Tupac Amaru from what happens with Bolivar. Yeah. What we don't see then is that revolutions are generational projects. And you've seen this tendency now to move towards this in American scholarship, where you can somehow have, say, 1765 to the Jeffersonian election. You can see you have one long, and that's getting closer, I think, to what people experienced, is a generational, long generational transformation. But it is significant how the silence of that, the way that we have not done that seems to me significant.
Yeah. Look, I think it's a huge challenge, really, for professional historians. And it's one of the ways I think we've not so successfully tried to get close to the experience, let's go for it, you know, reality of what happened. You know, it just is recognizing that, as you say, the people who are alive in, you know, lots of the people who are alive in 1775 are still kicking in 1805 and 1815. You know, they may be getting old, but they're still around. And to think about the ways in which that creates continuities and the ways in which the passage from one generation to the next creates discontinuities. I think it's hard to see that unless you foolhardily, as I did, insist on trying to work on this scale. And then it becomes almost essential. I mean, because I started working on this, you know, this time scale, if you're trying to talk about, as I said at the very beginning, you know, I wanted to have actual people, that there wasn't some kind of abstract, you know, political analysis. If you want to have actual people, and you want to be looking on this timescale, people are getting old and dying over the timescale, and new generations are coming to power. And you know, one of the things that I mentioned this in the book, but one of the things that there's almost a willful blindness to it. I mean, I remember when you teach. I mean, you've probably had this experience when you teach the early American Republic. You can easily give the impression that the people who basically lead the revolution just stay in power until Jackson shows up, right? Because it's true, right? The presidents, right? It's, you know,
James Monroe. I mean, he's like 19 getting shot at Trenton and he dies still wearing knee breeches in 1830.
Well, exactly, right? So okay. You get all the way to 1824 with presidents who are basically, I mean, Monroe is a bit of a limit case, but who are basically of the generation or who lived through the revolution itself. But what's amazing is as soon as you start digging below that, it's completely different. It's totally exceptional. you know, well, the majority of Congress is.
I remember blew my mind was how young the median age of the signers of the Constitution was. What is it? I think there are a bunch of 20 somethings, and I think it's 35. They're much younger than, they're much younger than we realize. And many of them have no real, they have no adult memories prior to the revolutionary movement.
So, and of course, that just accelerates, right? The more, as you go into the 19th century. And so, you know, especially if you look at kind of, I mean, you know, the books that really get sort of into the weeds of the political world in this period. So, you know, I think of, you know, Sean Wilentz on, you know, Rise of American Democracy or Chance Democratic, of course, which, you know, is really New York. But, you know, you get, or even Elkins and McKittrick, you know, these are the books that kind of really get, you know, you get biographies of every half-wit political operative in the country. But, you know, you really see how these people are shaped by the revolutionary legacy. They're not Washington and Adams and Jefferson, people who really, by 1775, are, you know, totally formed by the, you know, the 18th century world. So anyway, I you know, I think it's hugely important. I think it's, you know, one of the ways in which we get closer to the experience. And I, you know, I just want to pick up on this idea of ADD. I mean, I think one of the, look, who knows how, you know, books will be read and who will read them. But my hope is that for some of the people who read this, they'll think a little bit about, they'll find some encouragement in this idea that revolution is a generational project. Because I do feel that today, maybe this is always the way it is with revolutionaries, but it seems more and more like that to me. We have this real, you said ADD, and it has a quality of that. There's a kind of impatience with political and social change, a, you know, a desire, an understandable desire, given the mess we're in so many different ways, to, you know, could we finally please turn the corner? Could this be it? You know, this is the revolution that will change everything. And
everyone's looking for that one switch.
They are.
Or as it says in the all the spam, they get that one simple trick.
Exactly. Exactly. And who can blame people for wanting that, right? Who can blame them?
But like, the problem is I'm
a little okay. You will.
Them.
You will. But, you know. But the problem is not that. I think it's not that it's stupid to wish for that, because I think it's an admirable thing to wish for. But you're going to be disappointed. You're going to be disappointed.
Because
you're
it's a fantasy.
It's not going to work. It's not going to work. It rarely does. I mean, maybe once in, you know, 100 years you have some real political turning point. But I think to say to yourself, you know what? This is part of a much longer process. How can I think about this as, you know, building towards something that 10 years, 15 years from now? And I, look, I hear the people who, and I look, I sympathize with them. I agree. You know, people, when people say the climate emergency, we have to do something right now. Like, I agree. The problem is there are lots of people, as the 18th century revolutionaries learned only too well, there are lots of people who do not want things to change. People with power. And if you want to make things change, it takes a long time. You've got to really dig in, and you've got to push over long periods of time with a big coalition. And I think that's the story of the Age of Revolutions, is people very slowly figuring out how to build coalitions and figuring out how to kind of push change through against pretty extraordinary resistance. And so, you know, my hope is that whatever, that, you know, if there's a message to this book, that, that maybe that's part of it, that, that, you know, that there's hope, even when it seems like, you know, the revolution in the Netherlands is not succeeding, but it's still having an effect. It's still taking you somewhere.
Well, I should say to listeners that if you like that, we only covered approximately 5% of the book. There are hundreds of pages to go. So my guest today has been Nathan Pearl Rosenthal. He's the author of The Age of Revolutions and the Generations Who Made It. Nathan, thank you so much for being part of Historically Thinking.
Thanks so much, Al. Really appreciate it. This was a great conversation.
And thanks so much to you as well for being a part of Historically Thinking. If you like the podcast, then share it with a friend, or many friends. Vivian Lundy is our assistant producer. John Ruddat is our sound engineer. I'm Al Zambone, and I'll be back next week with more history to think about and to shape the way we think about the present.